We are very happy to host Badrul Chaudhuri in the Imperial Business Healthcare Podcast. We worked with Badrul previously for about a year, but Badrul is an MD, PhD with a specialty in internal medicine and allergy and immunology. Has a great career with 20 years at the FDA, being the director of the Division of Pulmonary and Immunology. And the last, I think, 3 years, Badrul, you moved to pharmaceutical industry.
That is correct.
So Badrul, thank you very much for joining our podcast. It's a pleasure to have you.
Thanks for inviting me to join this discussion with you. It is my pleasure to be here. I have a lot of respect for Imperial for a long time. Happy to be part of the Imperial podcast. Thanks.
Excellent. So, Badrul, we're going to start with some personal questions. So, can you tell us a little bit more about your background and maybe what inspired you during medicine or your future career?
Yeah, as you mentioned, I'm an MD and a PhD. My PhD is in immunology, and my residency training is in internal medicine and fellowship in allergy immunology. So I drifted more into the autoimmune disease space early on my career during my research fellowship. I did my fellowship at the National Institutes of Health, the NIAID, National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Disease. So at that time, I was more of a bench researcher trying to do lab science using my skills I garnered during my PhD time. Then I moved to academic medicine as a faculty in a medical school in the US. At that time, I was thinking, how can I build on my medical, clinical, and the research at the same time? And I went into a space which now has become translational medicine. So that is what took me into this clinical research area and to the FDA, where I could put the basic science, early clinical development, late clinical development, clinical trials into this space where I can relate to both. And my passion, my interest has been throughout in my life in being in research. And that kind of prompted me to come to the FDA. And you said I stayed there for 20 years, spent my whole career there, learning more about the research, more about translational medicine in the process, help some drug development, and get some drugs in the market with the pharmaceutical industry and serve the patients.
And Badrul, one of the perceptions that medical students have, I'm sure at Imperial and everywhere else, is like what you said, it was the translational research experience that helped you also with the FDA, because I would expect that you need more like clinical trials experience to go into the FDA, but this is not the case with your career?
It was the case that I was heading up the Division of Pulmonary Allergy and Rheumatology Products. It is a clinical division. However, in the FDA, and also it is true for many of the academic institutions, these are multidisciplinary groups. And in the drug development area, along with any scientific research, you ultimately end up in the patients, do a clinical trial and have a drug either approved or not. But to get to that stage, you go through initially proof of kind of principle study in cell lines, in animals, and in models. And these gradually has had a huge impact on drug development. In the older time, in the empiric drug development, you do clinical trials, not necessarily knowing how the drug works. And you do two clinical trials and you believe the trial has worked, therefore the drug must work. But now it has changed, and that's where the translational medicine comes up. That how much you know about the disease, how much you know about the natural history of the disease, how much you know the biology of the disease, the molecules involved, and how much you know of the drug acting on a particular target, particular pathway. So it brings in the concept of a prior probability of success in a clinical trial. So that piece is really more of scientific basic research. And regulatory bodies, industries have gone into these more and more than before. And that is where the basic research, the translational medicine actually has a role. And FDA relies on that a lot. And when I was at the FDA, that was my passion, which actually got a lot of interest by others, is looking at a drug, what is the prior probability in a clinical trial this drug would work based on priors? So that is a line of expertise I developed, not to discount at all the clinical trial piece. There are many people in the clinical trial piece who are experts in statistics. They can design the trial in a statistical way, interpret that, that is different. So both are valuable. It depends for a student in a medical school or in training now, how they envision themselves.
Interesting. Some becomes
more of a clinical trial expert of statistics, of design of a clinical trial, and some goes into the basic science. What is the prior probability of a success of a molecule? So I am more of this kind. And if you look at the regulations, it has actually changed in a lot of disease areas that FDA, also the European and Japanese, are accepting more limited database for approval of drug, not necessarily going in through a traditional clinical trial. And this limited database for approval actually builds on from the preclinical knowledge. And that played out extremely well in the oncology cancer drug development. Because in cancer, it is somewhat easier. You have a molecule or a cell line which shouldn't be there. That's the cancerous cell. And if you can find a molecule which is causing the cell to multiply, and there are many of them described in the cancer literature very well. So in normal health, this molecule is not there. In cancer, the molecule is there. And you can link the molecule to a cell growth and proliferation. Now, if you develop a drug to target that molecule, how much of clinical trial do you need? Right. One can argue not much. And that concept is actually coming along also in other disease areas where you and I are interested in respiratory diseases with the biologics.
Right, very interesting. So Badrul, this transition from working in a university hospital and then moving to FDA, was it a plan that you had for many years, guidance from a mentor, or an opening that you find just by chance? How this happened?
Yeah, this is an interesting question. A lot of persons have asked me these questions because typically as a medical student in a training, if one is looking for a job as a physician, what are the jobs you're looking for? You're looking to be either a physician in a clinic seeing patients, or you're trying to be in an academic center being a faculty and doing development of students and research. Or people have started to talk about a bit about pharmaceutical industry as a career where physicians have gone in. The regulatory environment was just not that much well publicized or well known. So for me personally, I was at the NIH for a part of my career. And in the Washington area, the NIH, FDA works very close by together. Many people between the two agencies go back and forth. So I had the exposure of knowing the FDA. Some of the people were actually in the same campus. So I knew about that.
Okay.
So I did not go directly that path from the NIH, but when I left the NIH, FDA was always in my mind. So I knew about it. But over the years, I think people have become more aware of the pharmaceutical side of drug development, so-called the commercial drug development, and people have learned more about the FDA. So I know in my time at the FDA, I have probably recruited about 40, 50 physicians from academic centers.
Yes.
Who have come and joined. So it has become more known. For me personally, it was simply being in the right place at the right time. And for most career, that's the way it happens. It's a timing.
It is totally. So moving now to the FDA, I'm sure that all our students would like just to listen from you. If you could just share from your career major accomplishments or challenges during these 20 years working at the FDA.
Yeah, accomplishments are a lot. And I mean, one of the things at the FDA, which I think students listening to this may also have to think, is FDA is a public health organization. So many of the accomplishments belongs to the US government or the FDA. It is not personal. So one, coming to these organizations of a public health kind of organizations need to accept and acknowledge that the personal accomplishments are lesser so because the way the organization is structured, it is organizational success. Even on that personal accomplishment, personal successes can happen. So for me, I would say I have fostered development of many drugs in varieties of indications in very challenging areas, including unmet needs and rare diseases. That has come to the market. So what people see at the end of it, a company and a drug for diseases, but there are many sweat and tears which has gone behind them. And FDA during my time changed its mission. It used to be a regulatory agency, like the industry will do the trial, FDA will review it, take a decision and regulate it. It has changed in the US with a congressional mandate of really being part of the drug development. So FDA actually inserts themselves in industry, welcomes that as being part of the drug development team. Many people in the FDA, it takes it onto themselves to be a part of the team. So I myself was very interested in doing that. So for many drug development, with many industries, I have used my knowledge looking at other drug developments, not crossing an intellectually bounded space, but giving them guidance so that they do not go down a path which others have gone by and led to failures, and guide them in a path more for success. So that is a big accomplishment I would say I have. There are again many small piecemeals, which are too many to kind of go through. One area which now is in the past is the interplay of the respiratory diseases and the environment. Now we talk about greenhouse gases, carbon footprint and all. It started off with a concept of ozone depleting substances and the chlorofluorocarbon, which used to be in metered-dose inhalers. So this was a 20 years or so of a UN-led endeavor to get the chlorofluorocarbon out of the use for medicines. So I worked on that being the US lead at the UN. And that was, again, a work that I have done, which I cherished and really enjoyed them. Also at the FDA, there's another piece of it that happens is FDA-sponsored research, which is done with money coming out of federal funds and go through typical research application process and get academic centers buy-in and do research. So I have done quite a bit of them. The center I used to work in is called CDER, Center for Drug Evaluation and Research. The R piece is what I'm talking about.
Right.
So
right.
I have done quite a bit of them using my thought and doing a funded research by academic institutions. Also, I have used company data, analyzed them in a very formal way, very thorough way, and then published it. These are all by within the government money. I've done many of them just to give one example, and then I close up this piece. You know, idiopathic pulmonary fibrosis has been a challenging area for drug development with no drugs for 50 plus years. And under my watch at the FDA, we have two drugs. And again, the industry, I thank them for doing their clinical trial, but we work with them to design the trial, to develop the trial, have a successful trial, have drugs in the market. Now, at that time, between two companies, there were three phase three trials done. And the three phase three trials actually had placebo arms. So it occurred to me and to my group that we actually have a natural history study with five placebo-controlled trials with half of the patients in placebo. So we could pool the placebo and actually doing a natural history to foster future drug development. And it was a long work because it was all proprietary data and we had all the legal clearances, got all the industry's participation, thanks for the industry, and got in a project funded internally and analyzed all the placebo data. And that actually, we published it. It kind of became the largest, if you would call it, that's a natural history 1 year trial in IPF patients. So these are the researches that I have done at the FDA, which I enjoyed.
And this thing that you're just mentioning, Badrul, because looking into the PubMed, we can see that you have a lot of publications, high impact factor publications. This research was on the job description of your position, or it was more like that you took advantage of some opportunities of funding and some data and you pushed research through FDA?
Yeah, this is what I wanted to do on my own. This is not part of the job description. The job description is really, if you would call it, do the regulatory review, take a decision, and move on.
Right.
And that is a basic minimum for a success. But I think most of the people coming out of Imperial will look for something more than basic success. So this environment is actually extremely rich in launching a lot of trials that one can do that is actually not possible in almost any other environment because the data is there.
Right.
You yes. come up with a concept. And before I left FDA, I actually launched another two trials, which is still ongoing, and which had multi-million dollar fundings from the government.
From the government?
From the government. This is all government funded.
Wow.
This is all government funded. So this is not job description, but I think more and more people are doing them now. People are doing them now.
And for the students, just to keep it simple that everyone understands, can you explain a little bit the process with a new drug, a new company coming to the FDA until the approval? So what are the steps for an approval of a drug?
The traditional steps is the phase one, phase two, phase three clinical trial, which I think anybody knows. I'll not go into that too much. I'm going to talk about the holistic process. So the first time the FDA will actually hear about a drug, when a company or an entity thinks it is ready to go into humans. So this really is before phase one, it is what we call it as a pre-IND. The word IND stands for investigational new drug. In Europe, there's a process called CTA. So that is the time FDA will interact with the industry. Now, many work goes before that, and I would start to go from there. First, in the drug development, one has to think about what is my target? What drug I am making? Assuming this is a directed drug development, not an empiric, suddenly you stumble into something. That happens a lot. So then you target a molecule or a path, develop a drug or a biologic to target that. So one of the early things that comes into, can you make that molecule into a drug product that you can give to humans? If you cannot make a formulation, then you do not have a drug. And many chemicals actually have fallen apart because you simply cannot make a formulation. So that is the early. And then one piece that actually is not looked upon is preclinical toxicology. What you hear more about preclinical proof of activity, proof of concept in animals. That is all necessary, all good, but it is a preclinical toxicology that directs, if you can go to the humans, what is the toxicity profile in animals? So you can base a dose and a monitoring program. So this is the early development phase. So I'll put it into chemistry and manufacturing, preclinical toxicology, along with also goes preclinical and laboratory proof of activity. At that time, the FDA will interact with the industry if the industry is to come in a setting called a pre-IND meeting. It is more of an advice, more of a discussion. Then IND is opened, meaning that a drug that can be given to humans in a clinical trial. So then the IND process opens up, and then one goes through this traditional phase one, phase two, phase three. Now people are calling more into proof of activity, proof of concept, and confirmatory. After that, industry is ready to file a marketing application, which is called a NDA or BLA, new drug application, the biologic license application in the US. And Europe has a process called MAA, marketing authorization application. So at that time, the drug is put on the market. So nowadays, some drugs are put on the market under a term called conditional approval, or under the COVID, I think people have heard the word a lot, emergency use authorization. They're different. So if a drug is put in the market under some emergency use or from conditional, then post-marketing, there's some required studies. And recently, I think AstraZeneca in the oncology area has come up and said they're going to withdraw a drug in the US market because the post-marketing study did not work that well. So those are, again, phase four studies, either required by the FDA for safety or as a condition for the approval, or the company wants to expand the market. So this is the whole drug development and life. It is very long, and it is not
uncommon. So how long? When we say long, how many years would you say?
The average people used to say, before the newer phases of and the biologics is coming to, it used to be about 20 years. So that was the time, and now it is, people are targeting more like seven, eight years. It is still long. And as physicians, I mean, if you think about it, I always relate to physicians. We as a physician for chronic diseases is never getting to see a whole disease in a patient from beginning to end. Some chronic diseases are very long because patient may outlive us or may move on. So as a physician, we see different windows of the disease and put it together in our brain what a natural history is.
Exactly.
Same thing in the drug development. You actually see windows and put it together in your head and see what a drug development is. And that particular window, seeing different windows, you cannot get anywhere outside the FDA.
Exactly. And this discussion just leads me to the next question, which is, you explained the process. It takes years. So I'm sure that all the students would like to listen from you. How come with this COVID vaccine, we were much faster bypassing a lot of the stages in this process?
Yeah, I think one has to first acknowledge many people actually misunderstand what the COVID vaccine, has it been really pushed through for political reasons quickly? I want to bring it up and say it clearly, it has not been. And this is based on my reading of the literature, reading of the science, and talking to some friends and colleagues who have been developing these. It has not. So what has happened? What was very quick? Before the COVID, the earliest and the quickest drug vaccine development was by Merck. I think it was in the mumps, which was about 4 years time that it took, and 2 years was in clinical development. Now, the COVID was less than a year. So what happened here? The science has developed to an extent that one could make a potential vaccine candidate in the laboratory and not necessarily take the longer approach which was taken before. And if you go to the vaccine, the classic example is a smallpox. The Jenner Institute is a smallpox vaccine out of Oxford, and it came by a serpentious discovery that the cowpox can prevent human pox. So it was accidental discovery, but science has moved further away. In the mumps time, which was the quickest discovery of a vaccine, this was about 40, 50 years ago, it was taking a vaccine and taking a virus and attenuating it to make it appropriate to give it to the human as a vaccine so that it does not cause the disease. So the science has led to a place where the current science informs the industry and the scientific community to make a vaccine construct before going through the lengthy process of attenuation. A couple of the vaccines, for example, the AstraZeneca one, the Johnson & Johnson one, the Sinovac one, and even the Russian one, used another virus as a vector, as a carrier. And those vectors are the carriers adenovirus base primarily, either from chimpanzee or from humans, has been pretty well known. So it did not take a long time on that construct to put in the COVID piece. And the COVID sequence, it was very quickly done by the Chinese long time ago. Even before the vaccine hit the Western world, the sequence was known. So they could make the construct pretty easily, pretty quickly. And the other piece which had some role, which is not in these vaccines, is the BioNTech and the Moderna, which use entirely different technology of RNA. So RNA doesn't even need any of these constructs. You just take the sequence and then you make it in the machines. So the upfront development has become much shorter. So that's what I was telling you, the drug development was 20 years. Now it is much lesser. The same thing applied. You could get to a vaccine, Moderna and BioNTech, within a week or so, they had the construct. The other larger companies had the construct very quickly. So that was one. Second, unfortunately for everybody, the clinical trials became much shorter because there were too many diseases happening.
Yeah.
So that's unfortunate, but that helped. 30,000 patients trial doing a couple of months time is unheard of. That's one piece.
That was faster because you're saying that they were easier to just recruit healthy volunteers and patients at risk to get the virus?
It was actually easier to do the trials in a 40,000 patient, 30,000 patients or so at risk, meaning they're exposed to, can develop COVID.
Right.
So infection was so rampant with such a big pandemic all over the world, industry could get to the patients, recruit them very quick.
Yep.
So that was also, unfortunately for the disease and for the patients, but drug development became quicker. The last piece is the regulatory piece. Typically, vaccines takes longer time to develop and longer time to review because you need to have traditionally a good idea when you approve it, how long the production is, what is the immunogenicity like, what is the booster schedule, what is the frequency schedule for multiple years. So this is traditional. So FDA and also all the regulatory bodies around has cut this out and introduced this way of approving a drug to the market, which is called emergency use authorization. So the emergency use authorization is a regulatory path which existed in the US for a long time. It really is exactly that. For an emergency, a use can be authorized without full knowledge and full testing of the drug in question. It was primarily for bioterrorism and nuclear disaster kind of scenario. It was applied for the coronavirus vaccine. So under the EUA, the vaccines were approved and put on the market without knowing how long the protection will last. When do you actually have to give a periodic booster? The concept here is you can know about them as the humans are getting the vaccines, because the trials are still ongoing. So that actually brought in the regulatory timelines much, much shorter, for some to a week. So actually, scientifically, regulatory, there's been nothing short-circuited. The efficacy has been assessed, safety has been assessed, the emergency use authorization at the back end of it make it very quicker. The scientific knowledge informing the construct of the vaccine in the front end of it became very quick. And the nature of the clinical trial with the pandemic raging became very quick.
And overall, Badrul, putting all this together, is this the fastest approval, actually the whole development of a drug in the last 100 years? Or do you have any other examples where it was faster even than the COVID vaccine approval?
Yeah, I think when you say drug, I would probably step back. And again, this is for the students. Like, what are the buckets of therapeutic agents that you think about? One is the drug, which is small molecule drug, the traditional drug that we know about. Second is the biologics, which is made in a biologic system and becomes a human therapeutic agent, such as monoclonal antibodies. There are many of them in the market. The third piece is the vaccine. And they're actually different. They are very different. For example, the small molecule world, drugs can be copied as a generic. Biologics cannot be copied as a generic. They're biosimilars. Vaccine has no copies. You cannot make a copy. So you have to put it in three different buckets. As far as vaccine goes, this is the fastest, the coronavirus. If you put it in the whole spectrum of drug development, I think it is so vast an area. There may be examples. I don't want to stumble into that and saying this was the quickest because yes, I do not know. But it sounds, this is probably one of the quickest.
One of the quickest. Okay, I think the whole process is very clear. One last thing about your experience in FDA. We touched on the accomplishments, a little bit about the challenges on this position. So you mentioned before that it is a very close collaboration with the US government,
yes,
being a head of a division at the FDA. Were there any challenges on that? Not political, but did you have to collaborate or work with like the Congress very closely, even on your approvals?
Yeah, this is something I think also worth for the students to pay an attention to, and which often in a typical research and medical training environment is not appreciated, is the existing laws, regulations in place. In drug development, in human research, there are a lot of regulations and a lot of laws in place in Europe, US, everywhere else. And this is something which is a challenge, is often coming from a lab setting or a clinical setting, one does not appreciate the laws and to abide by the laws and work within the constraints of the laws. So that is often perceived as a challenge by academic people or research people, not large pharma industries, often small biotech, coming to the FDA, very well thought out research that they want to do. And they have not gone through what is allowed by law. And pushing, why can't I do it? Because it makes sense to me. So that concept, it makes sense to me. You may be absolutely correct. And that may be the way science was done a long time ago. I refer to the Jenner's example. I mean, Jenner's took the cowpox and gave it to actually kids. And yeah. Can you imagine starting the clinical trial in kids with an animal vaccine? The current laws will not allow that. Exactly. So that is often a challenge even within the FDA to have people appreciate those laws are there for good reason has to be followed. So this is one aspect of the challenge. Other challenge, which is a mindset, that if you're in an academic setting doing your investigator-initiated studies, you're building in a career and an institute. I refer to Jenner Institute or the vaccine, the big one goes by a person's name. In a federal setting, specifically with the FDA, that personal entity is lost. Hmm. And many people actually have taken that as either accepting or taking as a challenge and has not found it very healthy environment to live in, because it is very difficult to grow one's personal career very fast. It has to go through a process. So that loss of person as a scientist, as a leader, it is very difficult to make at the FDA. I mean, I have kind of tried to do this by doing research on my own, but that's not typical. So that is often a challenge. And you brought up, I don't want to go there, is the federal bureaucracy, which is there in every big organization. Even taking aside the bureaucratic process, the FDA is a very large organization. There's lots of intertwining oversight and intertwining activities. The political pressure in the government within over the FDA is really not there. And they're left as an independent agency, and the government influence of do this or do that, that kind of activities is not there. Fortunately, I was not in the FDA in the last presidency in the US, which was probably a bit of an aberration, but generally it's not there. But going to the Congress, it is actually quite a lot and quite a bit of the work. And I think at the end of it, there are good reasons for it. while at the FDA, having a congressional inquiry and responding to that either in writing or physically going to congressional board and presenting and talking is very challenging, very demanding. And doing that, while you're doing that, often becomes very pressurizing. But at the end of it, there are good reasons for it, because everybody is accountable. So the Congress calls on the FDA to explain certain things that has happened. This is accountability. So that is there, but it is not that common. I mean, I had to go as head of the division, but most of the people in the staff do not need to do that. It's the higher level people who take that challenge.
Okay. Now I think that's crystal clear for our students. So Badrul, after this 20 years and all these successes and accomplishments, we see a career change.
Yes.
So the question is, how easy was for you to just make this career move? Were you prepared? Was it something that, what's the reasoning behind this change after these 20 years?
Yeah, I mean, it is kind of personal, and I think every person's situation is unique. And many people in the FDA, in fact, recently have chosen to stay with the government for their whole life and not make a career change. Stay with the FDA right to the sunset. Many people early on from the FDA, they come and stay for 3 years, 4 years, 5 years, go to industry. So they use FDA as a stepping stool for learning the research. The window I was saying as seeing a life of a disease, life of a patient, life of drug development. So that is a good chunk of people who come, take this as a training opportunity and leave. In my situation, it came to a time, being there for about 20 years, I could stay for another X number of years at the FDA and be the long hauler in the FDA, or take a switch and say, maybe I can contribute something on the industry side and do some drug development, help in the drug development process. And the industry would probably find it useful for somebody to come from the FDA. So that was the mind and thinking I was having when I crossed the 20 years. At a very personal level, the government gives time at which you can leave with the full benefit. It's purely the structure of the government job the way it is. So that was a time that I could.
Okay.
So essentially I could make a second career where I could be valuable. So I, in the industry, came to AstraZeneca because it had an area which was entirely aligned with what I was doing at the FDA. Subsequently, I moved to some other entity, in a smaller entity, having a larger control on what exactly research I wanted to do. So it is more, I would say, for personal gratification that I wanted to do. And coming from the FDA, I could probably go to industry and I could essentially, if you would call it, call my shots where I wanted to go.
Right. And now being on the industry side, what are the different challenges that you see from a pharma or biotech perspective on the drug development? Maybe things that you have not considered where you were on the FDA side, something new?
Well, this is a very good question and a very good point. And I think for the students, they need to understand the bigger picture. And often you understand the bigger picture the way I did by living through. And some others can actually learn this by reading and hearing. So the bigger picture really in the industry side, in the biotech side, is also different. Now, from an industry side, it is a big deal for a drug to be developed and get regulatory approval, because if you do not have a regulatory approval, there's nothing you can do on it. So FDA side, that is the picture that you get. Now, what you do not get, but I think people in the FDA also realize this fully, and I used to engage also on the other side, is for an industry to put money in a drug development, they have to see a commercial viability. And I call it commercial viability because many in the industry will probably call that. But from a physician standpoint, it is also the unmet need, improving on something which is already there for some patients, and serving the unserved. So that is a piece that from the regulatory side, we have a blinder on. Whereas from the industry side, that is a big piece. Am I developing a drug, putting money for a drug development that ultimately will serve some patient's need? At the end of it, will the revenue be coming, which is viable to put in the research? Because if the cycle is not completed, research will not happen. So that is a piece I think students should also keep in mind, is an important part of a drug development is, I would call it a patient viability of the drug development, which some of us may call it as a commercial viability of drug development. So that piece is there. Another piece, which is actually not appreciated in large pharma, is where is the money coming from? Because these clinical trials, if you do a clinical trial, I mean, it is not uncommon to have $100 million, $150 million for a typical phase three trial. It is not a small amount of money. So large pharma having a revenue stream can put the revenue stream back into that research. Small biotech, which most of the drug development in the world actually happens in the small biotech, they do not have that resources. So that money actually has to come from the capital market. And that capital market is managed by financial institutions and investment bankings and investment institutions and hedge funds and all. So that is another piece of drug development that often gets unnoticed. That if a small company is developed, they have a brilliant idea and a sure success of a drug development, who is going to back up their research? If it is large pharma, then they have their own revenue. If a large pharma trucks it over, it is their revenue. Other side, it actually is a capital market. So from a business standpoint, keeping this picture is important. I mean, if you look at the drug development cost compared to publicly funded research, when NIH has a dollar amount, how much of research they come in, and industry has also a dollar amount, how much research money they put in. Usually the industry dollar amount research is often 2 to 3 times higher than the NIH money.
Yeah, different.
So that piece is often not appreciated, is the financial aspect of research, fully knowing a vast majority of this research will not ultimately lead to a successful drug.
Yeah, that's a very important element. We have a lot of students, Badrul, at Imperial studying innovation, digital transformation, healthcare or biotech innovation. Now being in pharma and with all this experience, do you foresee any major changes in the way that we do drug development? Let's say post-pandemic, things are better with all these innovations that we have available.
Yes, this is going to happen. I think the overarching umbrella term people use is artificial intelligence or like huge databases. And that absolutely will change drug development going to the future. I mean, for example, some areas, particularly in the clinical pharmacology, it has already happened. The drug metabolism, drug-drug interactions, many of these in the older time was almost as a post-marketing experience. And then the enzymes are very well worked out and there are actually cell systems available where you do drug-drug interactions. And now it has become essentially computer algorithm that you know how the drug is metabolized and what is the potential interactions with other drugs. And all the CYP3A4, 2DCs and all of these things are mostly determined before doing any clinical study or before doing any clin pharm studies. So partly it has happened. In the clinical trial, this is coming on a lot because when you have more drugs, it becomes more challenging to do clinical trials. Because if you have one or two or three drugs, how can you design a placebo-controlled trial? And then how do you actually do a trial with an active comparator because your sample size goes up tremendously because you're comparing against another active. So in this area, there is a lot of research going on that can you actually shorten the clinical trial? Can you use innovative designs that you do not need as much as number of patients or even cut out clinical trials arms of the clinical trial? One concept, which is in the oncology area pretty much used, is synthetic control.
Hmm.
If you have done a lot of trials, you have a rough idea how a placebo will behave. So not have a placebo, synthetic control. And then many of the trials are also using information that you can by using known information from previous trial, applying it to the trial and make the trial shorter. And this is the whole concept of biosimilars and generics, is do a shorter trial. And finally, and there was a huge initiative from the Congress, and this came in the post-marketing situation, is creating a giant database of marketed drug and get information out of that. I'll just use one example. The biologics for asthma has changed the paradigm of asthma treatment. People believe that the biologics will save life, essentially have a mortality benefit, or at a lower level, hospitalization benefit, like less patient hospitalized. Now, you cannot upfront do a clinical trial with this biologics with a mortality endpoint, or even a hospitalization endpoint, the sample size will be enormous. However, this all becomes a natural history and the trial ongoing. When a drug is put in the market for the first time, right, the experiment has started because now the patient is getting a drug which was not there before. So with this idea, the Congress launched a post-marketing database in the US, which was under work for about 10 years or so. And then it was fully launched now. It's called a Sentinel database. Europe also has something counterpart. And many of these trials are actually happening in the Sentinel database for either adverse effects or even for benefit. That can you actually use this post-marketing database to have even a supplemental drug development or a supplemental claim, not actually doing a controlled trial? And the Sentinel database was actually developed for safety. And now it is being used even for other claims. And while I was at the FDA, I wrote up a protocol for actually using the exact for a different purpose and got pretty large funding for doing this. So these are the database-based clinical trials for artificial intelligence, which is coming in quite a lot to help drug development.
What about virtual clinical trials, these decentralized studies with the wearable technologies? What do you think about this?
It is absolutely the way. And it is happening actually around the clinical trial environment a lot because it is ultimately a cost benefit. Can you get more information with lesser number of patients with more database or database points? So these wearable technologies or monitorings or continuous measures actually do that.
Yeah.
So it is really getting into the same question in a different way. I mean, these are becoming essentially the norm of clinical trials. And with the COVID situation, unfortunately, it was pretty much of a difficult situation for doing respiratory trials. And COVID is fortunately going away. Is these technologies came into being for doing a trial in a virtual setting.
Yeah. So Badrul, in order to close this interview, on a personal level now, of course, you have a lot of things going on with publishing of research paper, drug development with your company. As an advice to our students, are there specific things that you manage your stress, how you can become more efficient, more productive? Any tips for our students?
Yeah, I mean, at some point, I look at it myself that the work should become interesting enough that it does not feel like a work. Easy to say, and I think it is hard to achieve, but I think it becomes very important. I can tell you from my personal level that why did I choose to become a physician or you become a physician? We made a choice at a certain point. In my way of growing up and going to a medical school and thinking, I became a physician always thinking that I will not necessarily be running after patients to see patients face to face. Not that it is unimportant, it's probably the most important aspect of being a physician. And most of the persons who become a physician was that. But it's again a choice. So I made a choice of being sort of a virtual physician, being in the healthcare sector in the FDA, being a doctor for all the doctors, being an interface between all the physicians and all the patients. It became a passion. So for me, I think often the work doesn't feel like a work. It feels like I just want to do this. So if your students can think about what do they like, some people may like doing benchtop research and they live their life in the laboratory and do not feel like it is a work, as opposed to somebody who wants to see patients all the time and is in the hospital in the ER and they enjoy it. Some people may enjoy playing with the data, doing analysis, writing a grant. So I think for the student, it is to find where the fit is and go to where the mind takes and the heart takes so that it does not feel like being at work. Because if it is, it becomes a bit of a challenge to keep it going.
Clear, clear. And what would be one piece of advice for those who want to venture into the business world of pharmaceutical for those students? What would you suggest?
I would suggest really to go for it, because it really is not the traditional place where physicians go. And it is awareness, and Imperial being a big center, I mean, they have the awareness, they have the knowledge of other places. So if something else interests somebody, going to pharmaceutical drug development, going to pharmaceutical industry, or going to a regulatory body, or doing something which is not the traditional path that most of the physicians take, venture into that, because as a physician, this is a very fortunate place to be a physician, because the breadth is a lot. And another thing I would say, also, I mean, I did that when I went to a graduate school, got a PhD, went to lab research, is not to lose the physician's connection. Meaning, have at least some connection with patients. I know many do it. Then you can appreciate both. A PhD, only a PhD cannot see a patient. MD, PhD can.
Yeah.
If somebody does an MBA, he can get into financial aspect of drug development, but an MBA only cannot see patients. So I would say for a student or a trainee is keep the physician piece always active, not to give it up totally. At some point in career, it becomes necessary, because that gives a huge leverage, both in terms of thinking, like what actually the patient's experience is, and also bringing that to the other parts, lab science or a financial world.
Thank you very much, Badrul. It was an absolute pleasure, and I'm sure that all the students will appreciate this interview.
Thank you very much. And I can see the recording still being on, but it will come off. It was wonderful talking.